Jesus is King. Welcome back to the Lay Apostolate on the Meaning of Catholic. This is a show where we talk about all things laity, lay domain, and I'm joined by my good friend, Mr. Eric Sammons. Eric, how you doing, brother?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on. This is exciting.
Yeah, this is the show that Eric and I have been waiting for, before I knew he was writing a great sci-fi novel. But this is what we're celebrating. This is the launch party. It's already been launched, but this is the party that we wanted to have together.
That's right.
So here it is, Shard of Eden, y'all. This is the first ever novel, also the first sci-fi novel of novelist Mr. Eric Sammons. This book is fantastic. I got to read it as before it came out, and let me tell you, it's fantastic. There's very few books that have moved me to tears in a good way. This was one of them. It delves deep into all sorts of important issues, and it's fantastic. So, Eric, how's the launch going? How's everything going with the book? Congratulations.
Thank you very much. Being called a novelist is something novel. Sorry for the pun. Honestly, a couple things. First is, one of the best experiences of this was receiving your text while you were reading it before it came out, because you're one of the beta readers. And you were messaging me whenever something you'd like something. And, of course, you had criticisms as well, which is great, which is why I wanted it. But it was just I would be very excited whenever I get a new text from you saying, like, oh, this is great. This part was it's like, okay, good. It's because, you were one of the first readers. And, I have a good editor in my wife. She's a professional editor. And she told me it was good. And she would not tell me that if it wasn't. But getting feedback from you was great. That was very exciting. The launch is going great. It's funny. I had to tell a few people who ordered the book directly from me that you had to wait because I sold out of my first batch of books that I bought. I underestimated how many people will be pre-ordering it, buying it from me. It's going great. You can get a signed copy from me. Just go to shardofeden.com, which is what the site is up on the screen right now, or at Amazon, of course. You can buy the paperback or the Kindle. It's been exciting. It was a little bit nerve-wracking at first. Do something new. I remember when I wrote my first nonfiction book, Who is Jesus Christ? That was back in 2010, so 15 years ago. And I was very nervous about that. And you get nervous for every book that comes out. But I got to a point where with my nonfiction books, I kind of knew what to expect. I kind of know who I am as a writer. I know who my audience is. And so it's not really that much of a, nothing really surprised me. With this, though, it's like, oh, who knows what's going to happen. But I've been very happy that the feedback I've gotten so far, people really enjoy it. I've said this somewhere else, but the funniest was one of my adult daughters was also a beta reader. And she's like her mother, so she would tell me if she didn't like it, even more so because she's my daughter. And the best part was when I was on FaceTime with her about, we were just our family chat or something, because she has a son, my grandson, and we were talking. And she goes, Dad, that book is really good. And she said with the most shocked, surprised voice. I'm like, you don't have to be that surprised.
So surprised that dad wrote a good book.
Exactly. Man. So that was actually pretty great too when my daughter enjoyed it as well. So it's been going well though.
Fantastic. And what's the best way to give you the most money and not the Matrix?
If you go to shardofeden.com, there's three links. You saw it up there. Yeah. Buy paperback and buy Kindle, go directly to Amazon. And so, that's not the greatest. I get money from it. I'm not telling people not to do that. I'm just saying. But if you go to signed copy, you get it directly from my website. I make more money, to be honest, with each purchase there. And I will sign the copy for you. I will sign the book. So that's probably the best way is to go the link to signed copy, which just goes to my personal website, ericsammons.com.
Great. Great. So. Well, we do want to support you and not the machine.
Yeah.
Speaking of machine, that's one of the subjects of the book. Obviously, it's not giving anything away because that's in the description is the AI.
Yes.
Which is a big question. I wanted to, so the broad topic here is the aesthetics of science fiction. Aesthetics is the philosophy of beauty. So it discusses what is art, how do you make art? And this is obviously literature, but it's a particular kind of literature that just cropped up in the past 100 years or so. And so do you want to give us any teasers about why people should read the book?
Yeah, so basically, I mean, I'm a big science fiction fan. My wife doesn't want me to call it science fiction because my wife is just like a normal person, unlike us. So she would never call herself a science fiction fan, but she really liked the book. And I know that's completely biased, but like she liked it and she does not like reading science fiction. And so she's like, if you call it science fiction, there's going to be people who really would like this book who won't read it. I'm like, yeah, but that's what, I mean, I can't help it. That's kind of, you know, so like you call it speculative fiction. The fact is it's set in the future. It's in space. What else are you going to call it? I mean, that's kind of, you know, you got to call it, you know, that I think. But the point is that, you know, good science fiction, I mean, there's hard science fiction for the geeks. We know this. There's hard science fiction. And then there's like just the soft or the regular science fiction. Hard science fiction gets really into the details of the science. I did not do that. I tried to make sure there was nothing in there that was against the laws of physics or, you know, something like that. But I wasn't getting details of exactly how the warp drive of a ship or, you know, all that stuff. I kind of like reading that sometimes, but that's not what I was trying to do here. This is very much just a story that's set in the future. And so, but I, you know, like I said, I do like science fiction myself, but anyway, that's the point. And so for me though, so I'm writing a book about artificial intelligence, a nonfiction book, A Catholic Guide to Artificial Intelligence. I've been very interested in artificial intelligence and for a very long time. My first 15 years of my career was as a software developer, had my own software development company for 8 years. My undergrad degree, my bachelor's degree is in systems analysis, computer science. And I remember when I got my degree in the early 90s, we were talking about, my professor was talking about the idea of we're going to be having code that writes code. And we kind of thought it would be sooner than it happened that you know, you'd have software programs that write code and you know, and artificial intelligence, in other words. And I remember there was like a introductory class to artificial intelligence back then, very rudimentary. This is, you know, because this is 35 years ago. So it's been an interest of mine. And so in writing this book, though, I kind of was like, I think there's value in writing this Catholic Guide to Artificial Intelligence, but there's also value, and this is where we come into literature, particularly science fiction. Science fiction often is a way to see our world today by looking into the future. Kind of like the idea is, okay, if we continue on the path we're on now, what is a possible future? Now, of course, dystopian literature often does, you know, what's the worst case scenario? My book isn't really dystopian, nor is it utopian. It, you know, has some dystopian elements, you know, in it. But it's really a matter of what does it mean to be human? What does it mean to have machines that work for us and potentially we work for them? And, you know, what's the purpose of artificial intelligence? Those are some of the issues that I address in the book, in Shard of Eden, but in a story format. You know, one of the things I don't like when the message becomes too much of a book, where it's obvious that the author is just trying to preach to you, and he throws a few a little story in there as well. No, I want to tell a story, but I do think good literature leaves you thinking afterwards, like, okay, you know, what are some of the you know, it leaves you thinking a little deeper than just like, oh, that was a good story. And so that's really what I was trying to do here with Shard of Eden, was particularly the issue of artificial intelligence is very key in the book, in the novel. There's other key elements, but that's one of the biggest ones. And because in the book, this isn't a spoiler, you find this out literally in the first pages, it's set about 20 years after an AI revolt, a war between machine and man that goes on for about 10 years, and the humans do win, But now the world is recovering from that and the implications of that. And one of the big debates in this world is, okay, do we just jettison all AI? Because look what they did to us. They caused this, you know, terrible war. Or do we try to make AI work for us? And I'm not, and the what I try to do in the book is, I'm not saying there's a right answer. What I'm saying, I'm letting the different characters kind of give their views. I have characters there that are very much on the side of get rid of it all. Characters that are on the side of let's try to adapt it and use it for our purposes. So those are some of the things that go into in a story that drives it home. Like I said, I really try not to preach, but I do think those are good stories are about us, about real life. In real life, we have these issues and we talk about this stuff and we try to work it out. So,
yeah, it seems to me that there is some essence of what makes a good story, like you mentioned a little bit. And there are some messages where they're trying to preach too much. Can you elaborate any more about what makes good literature? We have, and particularly for the fact that lay people do literature in particular far more often than clerics. It's kind of a lay domain. And also the Bible is a bunch of stories, and God communicates to us via story. So can you elaborate on more of what makes a good story, what makes a not so good story?
Yeah, I think that the part about the Bible being full of stories, I think that's very important. When God decided, okay, how am I going to reveal myself to my people in written form? He didn't give us a catechism. And I think that's very important to note. You know, I'm writing a Catholic Guide to Artificial Intelligence. That's not, and I'm happy to do it, and I hope people will buy the book, and I think it'll be very helpful. But that's not how God decided to really teach us. He didn't say, okay, I'm going to give you a catechism. Instead, he basically just had us write down stories of how he interacted with us, how we rejected him, how we followed him, all those things. That's really what the Bible is. I mean, yes, there's wisdom in literature in there. There's the letters of St. Paul. But even the letters of St. Paul, you can tell when you read Paul's writings, his preaching was mostly telling stories. He tells the story about himself, how he persecuted the followers of Christ. And he was a Pharisee of Pharisees, things like that. So stories are the way we're built by God. That's how we learn things. I mean, look at our Lord himself. He didn't get up there and preach a theological treatise. He told parables. Yes, we had the Sermon on the Mount. I'm not like saying he didn't ever, say specific like preaching, but mostly his teaching was in parables, telling stories, in other words. And so for us as lay people, we need to recognize that evangelization, which is something I've been involved in for my whole life as a Catholic, and before I was a Catholic as a Protestant, I was a director of evangelization for a diocese. You know, I've read a book called The Old Evangelization. And a key part of evangelization is telling stories. You tell the story of how God worked in your life. You tell a story about how God worked in somebody else's life, something like that. So stories are so important. And so when it comes to good literature, I think the key is, when you're writing a book, do you have a story first or do you have a message first? And I think you need to have a story first. I actually had the core idea for this book I had about 10 years ago. And I wrote a bunch of notes, outlined things, and I ended up just not having the time, the ability to write it at that time. But then I picked it back up and I added, and a lot of the artificial intelligence had nothing to do with the story originally. The other key part of the story, which I'm not going to talk about here because it's spoilers, that was the main kernel, and still is the main kernel, back then. But then it's like in writing the story, a message comes out. I never thought though in writing it, oh, I want to make sure I tell this or that. That's what I do in my nonfiction books. I'm like, okay, in my nonfiction books, I have an outline of, okay, what message do I want to, relay? What do I want people to learn? I'm being a teacher, in other words. In this novel, I never was thinking, my attitude was never, what do I want people to learn? What do I want to teach them? No, I was like, what story do I want to tell them that will engage them and entertain them? And in doing that, because I'm a person with beliefs and ideas and thoughts, those things seep into it and they become part of the story. but they weren't like, okay. And you see this especially in like some of these evangelical Protestant movies and things like that, like Left Behind, stuff like that. It's like all these movies they make, they're like, okay, we have a message we want to give, and we're going to try to find a story to pigeonhole into it. It's like, no, it's got to be you're telling a story. And yes, a message, because any story you tell, you are telling a message. It's impossible to tell a story, a good story, without telling, you know, a message. And I think this is, of course, the great debate a little bit between J.R.R. Tolkien and C.S. Lewis. And like, I would be very clear. I'm a huge C.S. Lewis fan. His space trilogy is awesome. I, in fact, dedicate this book to C.S. Lewis and a couple others. My novel, I love C.S. Lewis. I'm not saying anything against him. However, this was the debate between Tolkien and Lewis between Lord of the Rings and Chronicles of Narnia. Chronicles of Narnia clearly is Lewis just basically trying to tell the story of Christianity in this other world. Like, what would happen if God was incarnate in another world as Aslan, which is great. I mean, how many people have been positively impacted by it? Tolkien, however, in Lord of the Rings, that's not what he was doing. He was telling, you got to dig deeper. You got to, like, you know, there's been books and books written about what is the message of Lord of the Rings, and there's some debate about it, but I think it's clear for people who pay attention. But it really was. And so the truth is, Lord of the Rings is a better story than Chronicles of Narnia. I just think that's objectively true. It's not, I mean, Chronicles of Narnia is still better than 99.99% of everything ever written.
Right.
About. But, you know, it's not the same thing. And so I'm more of the let's tell a story, and a message will come out, because your message is like just who you are. Like, you know, because like in my book, for example, everybody basically is Catholic because the world has basically converted to Catholicism because in light of all the terrible things that have happened, most people are Catholic. The main characters are all Catholic. The Pope is part of it. There's a priest in it. But that's not because I'm like, okay, let me shove Catholicism down your throat. I'm like, no, I'm Catholic. That's who I am. That's what I know. Good storytelling is you say what you know. You tell what you know. And I know Catholicism. You know, I might not be great at always practicing it, but I know it. I mean, I have a theology degree. I've lived it out for years. I've debated it. So that's kind of, I think those all, that you write about what you know. So sure, my book, the characters are Catholic and things like that, but it's not a matter of, let me just shove Catholicism down your throat. In fact, I'm hopeful that non-Catholics will read. I've had a number of friends from high school through Facebook who, you know, I took English class with, and we wrote, you know, stories together, and they're buying the book and they're not Catholic. In fact, one of them was telling me, yeah, I've fallen away from the faith. I kind of reject Catholicism. I hope your book, I can still read. I say, oh, I think you'll enjoy the book. And so, yeah, I'm hopeful that will be, because they never buy any of my books, my nonfiction books. They're
right,
not going to buy, you know, Deadly Indifference or The Old Evangelization or Who is Jesus Christ. But they do buy that. A number of them did buy this book. And I'm hopeful they just like the story. But if it also maybe puts something in them that says, hey, maybe God is real. Maybe I should, you know, God is somebody I should think about. That'd be great, too. I would love that.
Now, why should Catholics read science fiction?
Okay, so science, I actually had an interview on my channel with M.R. Leonard. Do you know who that is, the guy who wrote Pilgrims? Have you read that yet?
I don't know him.
Tim, you got to read it. Oh,
okay.
I won't grab it because it's sitting over on the other side of the room. You got to read it. Here's the pitch. I'll give you the elevator pitch. I know you're going to want to read it because I feel like it's one of the best elevator pitches I've ever heard. Aliens arrive on Earth and they go to the Vatican. They speak Latin.
Sold.
Yes, sold. Exactly. That's exactly what I thought. I was like, I'm sold. And it's a good book. It's a good book. But what was your question again? Because it had something to do with
like, why should Catholics read science fiction?
Oh, yeah, right.
Like, okay. Shouldn't we just focus on Dante and all that sort of thing?
MR, first of all, Catholics, we need to baptize everything. If it's not explicitly evil, we baptize it. And there's basically nothing humans make just about that's explicitly evil, only evil. I mean, obviously, you don't baptize an abortion or something like that, but you know what I mean. It's like all culture, we baptize. And so science fiction, and this is why I was bringing up M.R. Leonard, Michael is his name, you know, because in talking to him, he actually fell away from the Catholic faith partly from reading atheistic, materialistic science fiction. And now that he's come back to the faith, you know, he has a degree from MIT and stuff like this, super smart guy. He's like, I want to kind of, I want to reclaim science fiction, because historically what happened was science fiction has existed for hundreds of years, but really last 100 years is when, especially in the 1930s, after 1950s, that's when it really kicked in. The problem is the first writers of science fiction that were really popular were very much dominated by atheists, by materialists. In fact, the main guy who ran, I can't remember his name now, who ran the magazines and stuff that kind of dominated the field, he was an atheist, materialist. He favored those books. So most science fiction, historically, since the 50s, has been written by people who basically reject God. So they write a future in which God is rejected. There is no God. Everybody acknowledges that. They think it's kind of childish to believe in God. Religion doesn't exist anymore. People don't really accept. And so most science fiction either just ignores religion completely in the future, or they denigrate it. There are notable exceptions, which are great, but that's just the reality of what happened. And this is terrible. This leads people away from the faith, because you get somebody who is maybe a science type guy, maybe a geeky guy, nerdy guy like you and me, and he likes science fiction. He reads some science fiction, and it starts to imprint in him, because they're telling a message too. Sometimes they're more explicit, like Gene Roddenberry's Star Trek. We'll get in that in a minute. He was more explicit at times. But even when they're not being explicit, it's just their worldview. Just like I said, my worldview is Catholicism, so Catholicism seeps into my storytelling. The same is true for the materialist, the atheist. And so much of science fiction has that. And I really believe, as Catholics, we can't just punt that category, that genre, and say, well, we're just going to, you know, give that over to the atheist. No, that's ridiculous, because you have some 14-year-old kid who loves science fiction because he likes science. He likes thinking of space. He likes thinking of aliens. He likes, you know, all that stuff. Are you just going to say, well, go read all this crap and get imbued with this atheistic worldview, and eventually you'll probably turn atheist too? So that's why we really, as Catholics, we have to, I think, reclaim every genre, make sure we have everyone, but science fiction, which is very popular. I mean, we have to remember, science fiction, when I was a kid, science fiction, you're almost kind of embarrassed to let people know, because people knew you're a nerd if you did that. You kind of didn't, you know. But now,
things have changed now. I didn't know that.
Well, I mean, people still know you're a nerd, but that's kind of cool now. Okay. I mean, science fiction, I mean, just think about the movies and all that stuff, and you know, comic books. I collected comics as a kid too. I'm totally outing myself as a complete nerd. I don't mind.
I had comics, yeah, sure.
Yeah, but like, You hid those from the cool kids. You didn't let people know. Now it's like there's, you know, every blockbuster movie over the past 15 years
is
based on comic books. You know, comic books I read as a kid. So like, and I think we reclaim comic books too, by the way. I'm not, you know, I think like comic books, you know, should be reclaimed too. There's actually there's a guy, Eric July. He's got this comic books company he started called Ripaverse. And he's a Christian. He's not Catholic. And he's a Christian in an interesting way, because like on his podcast, he curses a lot and things like that. And so I'm not like endorsing everything about him, but I do. He couldn't stand the wokeness that was infecting the comic industry. And so he said, I'm going to create comic books that are not like that. And so like, I just think that as Catholics, we need to do stuff like that. We need to say, okay, we need to be creating, you know, you and I, our job, our full-time job is what? It's critiquing, it's exposing and opposing the cultural problems of today. That's what you do at 1 Peter 5, meaning Catholic Pelican. That's what I do at Crisis. And I think that's important. I wouldn't do it full-time if I didn't think it was important. But we also have to create alternatives. As Catholics, we have to create alternative cultures. And it's, you know, it's not just, because I feel like this is especially true for trads. And, you know, I'm sorry, but I'm going to talk to our fellow trads, is we have this knee-jerk reaction of like, okay, this is evil. We're going to have nothing to do with it. Kind of a purity spiral. This is our danger we have. On the normie side, their danger is they just embrace it unquestioningly. And they're like, oh, it's not that bad. It's got this good, whatever. On the trad side, it's we reject it and we have nothing to do with it. I think what we need to do is that balance is we reclaim it and we make it Catholic. We baptize it. And so that's one of the big reasons why I was very excited about writing this science fiction, because it was something different for me, where instead of just saying the culture here is terrible, I'm saying, hey, here's an alternative, something that you can read, you can give to your teenage son who's into science fiction for Christmas. He can read, and you know, okay, it's not going to have cursing. It's not going to have nasty scenes in it. And more important, most importantly, it's going to have a Catholic worldview. He's not going to be turned away from the faith by reading this. He might even deepen his faith a little bit by reading. I'm not claiming it's going to, like, you know, it's Confessions of St. Augustine, but, you know, it might help him even a little bit. So that's why I really feel like we just can't give away aspects of the culture, and science fiction is a major aspect of our modern culture. We can't give it away as Catholics.
Yeah, for sure. What do you think about this? It seems like good literature, because I'm thinking of like television shows like in the 90s growing up that are just really showing a false reality where people, you know, they sin, but there's no consequences or that sort of thing. What do you think about literature as a vehicle to put you in contact with real reality? Even if it's science fiction, where we're talking about something that's a fantasy, right. Thoughts on reality, realism, and literature.
Yeah. Well, you know, one thing about science fiction, people, they might get hung up on the scene, but really it's just a setting for a story that tells stories about the human condition. That's what good science fiction is. I like the hard science fiction. It gets geeked up on some of the details. And that's fine because it makes it more realistic. I mean, you know, realistic in that sense of like, okay, the science actually works like this, something like that. But ultimately, that's almost an aside. It's really what is the story of the human condition of people. And I think the key here is like, okay, here's one example. I remember 9/11. I was living in outside Washington, D.C., not far from, you know, the Pentagon got hit, of course. And so it was a big deal everywhere, of course, but it was a big deal where I was living because I was like, oh, shoot, it could happen. You know, it happened here. That happened on a Tuesday. I remember George W. Bush, the president at the time, he called for like a national day of prayer, and all the Catholic churches had mass at noon on that Friday, a couple days later. And like other churches, you know, Protestant stuff did the same thing. I went to mass at a local parish down the street from where I worked. This was outside DC, and it was standing room only. And it was a huge church on a Friday at noon. And what I heard was, it was like that around the country. That was the reaction people had immediately in the aftermath of this tragedy, is people flocked to God. They returned to God and they realized, okay, we need something more than this world. We need to depend on God. However, when you watch the vast majority of movies, TV, read books, when there's a huge crisis, some major thing happens, it almost never shows people reacting like that. People turning to God, people praying, people going to church, going to mass, whatever the case may be. It just ignores that when that's exactly what humans actually do. So it's not realistic in any way, shape, or form when you see some TVs particularly, and movies are particularly bad about this. Like aliens will come and they'll blow up like a city or something like that. Like Independence Day, which is my guilty pleasure.
Welcome to Earth.
Yeah, I love the movie Independence Day, and I love it as it is. I'm not trying to act like it's some great, great thing like that. It was something my son and I, but we both love. But anyway. But, you know, the aliens do all this stuff, and you have one scene where a Jewish guy is kind of leading some people in some prayers, a couple people, but there's no real sense of like religion. And like, that's so common, and you see it all the time. And so I think that's an example of, you know, when we tell stories about the human condition, how would people really react in these situations? How do people actually act in these situations? So I think those are things that we want to tell in stories, and that's people identify with that. And maybe then they'll be like, it maybe even tell the story in such a way that they're like, you know, I need to think a little more deeply about these issues than I would have otherwise.
Yeah. It seems like good literature moves your heart because it's presenting persons who are dealing with whatever, and they're dealing with it in reality, in real life, in the sense that they're acting like real human beings would act in a situation, which moves right. You. And that's what captivates you for the story. So why do you like Star Trek so much? Because it's totally atheistic.
Okay,
what's
so
wrong with you?
Star Trek, that is the big thing. Okay, first of all, that's why I got started on. I remember when I was a kid, I grew up in the, you know, I was born in the early 70s. Grew up in the 80s, and I remember as a kid, this was probably maybe I was 12 years old, something like that, so early 80s, the local television station had Star Trek original series reruns on every afternoon after school. And so, and I, my, you know, we had TVs in our house. We didn't really realize, my parents didn't realize that wasn't good. I had TV in my room even. Now, of course, there was like four stations you could get back then. Yeah. It wasn't like now where, you know, you get HBO or something like that into your room. But not saying that was healthy anyway. I wouldn't do that for my kids. But the point is, though, every day after school, I would watch an hour of Star Trek, and I fell in love with it. I just thought it was the greatest thing. And, you know, as a 12-year-old, and as a Protestant 12-year-old, I'm not like able to see some of the issues with it. And I remember when it was announced Next Generation was coming. I think that was 87, something like that. I was so excited. I was like, this is the greatest thing ever. It's my birthday all and Christmas wrapped into one. And I love Next Generation. The first two seasons are awful, but I love Next Generation. I watched Deep Space Nine. Loved Deep Space Nine. It's probably my favorite because it actually does have religious themes in it explicitly, because Gene Roddenberry had died. And so they could like now put them in more explicitly. That's why I liked about Deep Space Nine actually was they showed people religious who, you know, how a religious person would act in these situations. And so I thought that was very good. Voyager, you know, it was okay. Enterprise, I kind of stopped with Enterprise. But the thing is, Gene Roddenberry, if people don't know, who created, you know, Star Trek, he was an atheist, materialist, and very anti-religious. His future was one in which basically original sin doesn't exist anymore. It's outlandish. I mean, economies don't work like they actually work in real life, and there is no religion. I mean, it's completely farcical. And that's what, as I got older, I wasn't sure was more offended by the religious aspects of it or the economic aspects of it. Because he made like there's no money, and like, you know, somehow when humans discover warp drive and all of a sudden they meet other aliens, now all of a sudden they don't have like peace and prosperity, just all of a sudden happens, like they don't have these original sin anymore. It's crazy. And so I like Star Trek, though, because at its best, it's very good at telling stories. It's very good at the human. It's very good at its best of really real life people in these crazy scenarios. You know, they're you know, on the other side of the galaxy meeting some alien, or, you know, and they're beaming down to planets and all that stuff. Okay, yeah, all that stuff. I like it, but I understand not everybody might like it. But like my wife, I got her to like Star Trek. And she's, like I said, she's not a science fiction fan, but she enjoys Star Trek as well. At least she tells me she does, and that's good enough. but yeah, so I just think that, like, if I was watching Star Trek with my younger kids particularly, I would make sure, I'd be clear to them, what are some of the flaws here in their worldview that we need to look at? And some Star Trek episodes really are explicitly anti-religious. I mean, they really are bad. And in others, though, it just seeps in because the writers, that especially in the old days, were very good at understanding the human condition. You understand then, I mean, it has truth, natural law. I mean, things that we can know by human reason do seep in there. And I just think it tells that story, you know, it tells the human condition story in a lot of great ways. So yeah, I'm a fan of Star Trek, always have been. I do not like the new. I do not like any of the new stuff. I like Picard season 3, but other than that, I don't like Discovery. I have watched very little of it. I just don't like any of that. The new movies, the Christopher Pine movies that were done, I actually like them better than I thought I do. I rewatched them recently, but they're still not great because they're much more just like, let's show action on the screen, not like let's tell a good story right underneath. So they're more like let's make them blockbuster action flicks rather than like, let's really talk about the stories of who these people are, that's what Star Trek is. That's why Star Trek wasn't hugely popular movies. In the original movies, because they're much more geared towards telling stories of a deeper level than they are, okay, let's show a laser battle in space.
Right. I noticed a tweet you had, you were condemning the trailer for the, what's the name of the new one? Starfleet Academy. You said something like, this is a betrayal of everything Star Trek stands for, or something like that. So, I watched the trailer and I was like, I mean, I guess I'm easily entertained perhaps, but, tell me what don't you like about what is the essence of Star Trek that feels betrayed?
I think what's okay. People say that like all Star Trek's always had a message. Yes, it has, but it has a story first. It's the whole story versus message thing I've talked in the past. Now I feel like modern Star Trek, it very much is just trying to hammer home the message and just knock you over the head with the message without really, not caring about the story first and foremost. And you see in Discovery, you know, they have the gay characters and all that. And you always have the girl boss. The girl boss character is one of my things I hate. I hate the girl boss character. I don't mind a strong one. Like, I think Princess Leia, I actually wrote an article for the Federalist years ago about how Princess Leia is one of the best female characters in movies because she's clearly a strong woman in the sense that she's got, know who she is, stuff like that. But she's not the one busting down the doors, shooting people up. She has to get rescued by the men, in fact. But she's a leader in a feminine way. I'm talking about the original series, by the way, the first three, not the leader.
7, 8, 9. Okay.
Yeah. Not the one where she's floating in space or whatever, crazy stuff like that. But like that was what, and that's because the reason is not because George Lucas was some great understander of women, but because our culture had not yet completely denigrated to the point where we don't even understand what men and women were. This was done in the 70s when there was still a cultural artifact, you know, from when we understood what women were and men were. But now it's like, we have to make sure every woman is basically perfect and strong and like is written like a man. I mean, that's what they do. And, you know, like, get a little geeky here, but like, you know, they have a Jim Hadar female. There are no Jim Hadar females because Jim Hadar are just made for, I'm sure they'll have an explanation for it.
Oh, they have a Jim Hadar female in the new one?
In the Academy trailer. Yeah,
oh, I didn't even notice. Okay, yeah, I wasn't Trekkie enough to catch on that.
They have a Klingon wearing a skirt, a male Klingon wearing a skirt. What? Yeah, watch it again. Watch it more carefully.
I'll have to watch more closely.
What it is like, okay, we have to shove our gender ideology down your throat, and we're going to show complete disdain for the original fans. By just screwing up every aspect story because we have to shove down this ideology. And I really think, I mean, there are almost no movies that I like over the past 5 to 10 years. It really started, you know, I think it started with the election of Trump in 2016, led to this reaction where they're like, okay, we're just going to shove our woke ideology down your throat. Okay. And like, I just don't like, and I think like there's so much a lack of creativity in writing women characters in these stories now, because they're always girl bosses. They're basically the only way these people think they can show strong women is to show women who can beat up men. That's what they think a strong woman is,
which is not real life. Unfortunately,
that's not real life. And if you try, yeah. I mean, and it's so unreal. Like, okay, if a woman has superpowers in, you know, a super, and she can kick butt, Wonder Woman, whatever. Okay, fine. But like, I'm getting now my pet peeves, but like Black Widow, you know, the woman who plays her, Scarlett Johansson, couldn't probably even beat up me. And I'm like, you know, an old dude that couldn't, you know, do anything. And yet somehow she's shown beating up these, you know, huge, like Navy SEAL type people. And it's like, it just so, like, I get that science fiction, superheroes, stuff like that is unrealistic. It's not like you're not trying, but that's the whole point is good science fiction actually is realistic. It's like what you're saying about the reality. And so like, but it's just like, they're trying to show there's no difference between men and women. And if there is a difference, women are better. Women don't have any problem. You know, the only problem women have is people not appreciating how great they are. I mean, that's really what they're telling, the story they're telling. So, and I think Star Trek got all of that and more in the new stuff, like with Discovery and with this Academy thing and Lower Decks, stuff like that, and honestly, it's kind of the inspiration for me writing Shard of Eden is like, I'm just tired of that. And it's like, and so like, here's an example in my book. So in my book, it's set in the early 22nd century. The Vatican actually has an army. It has, and it has the big military on the earth. They're the ones who send this. It's almost like a military expedition out into deep space. Well, every person on the ship, all six of them are men, because I was like, no, in a real world situation, you don't send women on this voyage. You only send men. And so all the characters on the ship are men. And all the in there's flashback scenes to the war between AI and the and man, and the military people fighting are men, because in my world, this future, people start to realize it's stupid to send women into combat.
Real life.
And so it just doesn't work. And so that's in my setting, I'm like, I want to make this actually realistic in that sense, not like this fake, okay, a woman who weighs 120 can beat up some, 250 pound all muscle guy or something like that. It's got to be realistic in that sense. So I consciously thought of that when I was writing Shard of Eden, was like, okay, I'm not going to put like women in military roles, because in my future, again, the Vatican has come to its senses, first of all, and it's like leading, it has an army. It wouldn't have women in combat, just like it wouldn't have done during the Middle Ages with the Crusades.
So what I have found interesting about Star Trek is that it has this explicit message from the very beginning, which is totally anti-Christian, humanism, atheist, whatever. But then there's these stories of TNG season 1, season 2, where the actors are being asked to play these roles where there's just no conflict. Everybody like figures it out. The aliens are the problem. The humans just figure it all everything out. And the actors themselves have a hard time creating this literature because it's so unrealistic.
Yeah.
And so as the Star Trek series go on, as you say, DS9, there's even like the Section 31, there's like corruption, right, that comes in. So there's like, as they just try to make good literature, their whole premise begins to fall away. So it's right. It's an interesting literary experiment to see that progression.
It is interesting because Gene Roddenberry, he's one of the people I dedicated my book to. I did Gene Roddenberry, Isaac Asimov, and C.S. Lewis. So I'm not like a hater of Gene Roddenberry, but he was an idiot when it came to understanding humans. Like I said, he rejected the idea of original sin, whether explicitly or implicitly, I don't know. But like the fact is, until we get to heaven, we're not going to get along with each other. I mean, it's always like the idea, people think that like monks in a monastery, it's like this almost heaven on earth. They get along with each other. You talk to an actual monk, they'll tell you, no, that's not how it is. You get super annoyed by yourself, the guy in the next cell and so, all that stuff. So, but like, yeah. And so as an actor, if you're a good actor, what are you going to do when your character just gets along, has no problems, no conflict with the people around you? And it makes for a terrible story if there's no conflict as well. And so that's what was nice. But frankly, I mean, I think the original series was great in a lot of ways. Next Generation early on started tough, but got much better. And honestly, as they got away from Roddenberry's influence is how it got better in a lot of ways. And I feel like the high point was Deep Space Nine, because you had people who are idealistic in a lot of ways, which is good for, I like a positive. The truth is, I feel like you go too far with that. Like, although Deep Space Nine is my favorite, people always talk about it being dark. It was still, though, optimistic. And I personally like optimistic, science fiction. I like some dystopian, but I like optimistic in some ways, in the sense of like, it's not just so heavy and dark and everything like that. And so, but I didn't think Deep Space Nine crossed that border into being too much. In fact, I thought Voyager was the big missed opportunity, because you had a situation where they really could have gotten into what it would be like to be stranded on the other side of the galaxy, in the Alpha Quadrant, I can't remember which quadrant they were in.
Delta.
Thank you. The Delta Quadrant, 100 years away, at maximum warp, whatever it was. And like, there's real stories there. And they punted completely after the first, I think, season, maybe even earlier than that. And they just made it a redo of like, everybody gets along. I mean, because they had these two crews that come together that it should be in conflict. They dropped that whole conflict, internal conflict. They dropped the whole idea of like the struggle. Really, I mean, they always talked about going back, but everybody seemed to be fine being in, 100 years from home, when they wouldn't be fine. There'd be real, I think you could have explored that a lot better. So I think there's a balance there of, having the real human condition, which isn't always pretty, but I'm not one who wants it to be completely just like depressing either, because I get that in real life. You know, I don't need to have it, you know, in all my, you know, that's a, probably why I like Independence Day, because even though it's like a dystopian thing in one sense, because these aliens come, they destroy cities and stuff like that. In the end, the good guys win. Will Smith is cool, you know, all that stuff. So,
why is Star Trek better than Star Wars?
Well, I mean, it's obviously better. It just should be self-evidently obvious that it's better. I think because it gets deeper into, I think honestly, because Star Wars is three movies and that's it. And other than that, there's nothing to it. I mean, I know there's a lot of books written. I read a few of them back in the day, but it's three good movies and, you know, six more movies or however many there are now that aren't that great. You know, some are better than others. I'm not like, you know, saying they're all terrible. Some are terrible, but some are better than others. But whereas Star Trek, you have this whole corpus, you have a true like world, you know, system and everything. And like a great example, I just saw this one the other day. There's a classic Star Trek Next Generation episode where they explain why all the aliens are humanoid. Of course, we know the real reason is because of budget. They couldn't, like, you know, create aliens that look too much unhuman-like. But they explain that, and it, like, it's a great explanation.
Is that the Great Race, where they're all, like, racing for that?
Yes. Yeah, and I can't remember the name. I don't think that's the name of it, but yeah. And basically what it is, like, there's one species that was humanoid. Here's a little fun fact. We'll get super geeky. They have a woman play on a hologram that race existed, and it's the same woman who plays the founder. In fact,
I knew that. Like right. Yeah. I've never seen. Yeah.
In Deep Space Nine. But so anyway, though, but the explanation is like they basically seeded all the planets with, with their DNA. And so that's why Cardassians and Klingons and humans all basically look alike with just some cosmetic differences, which I thought was a creative way of doing it. We can have some issues of like, you know, how God fits into that. I get that. But I think Star Trek just goes, it's better human stories. And I think some of that just because it can go deeper, because we're talking, you know, three seasons of original series, seven right. seasons of the rest, all this stuff. It can just go a lot deeper into those things in Star Wars. Star Wars is a fun flick. The three series. I mean, I love the redemption arc for Darth Vader. Spoiler for anybody who hasn't seen Star Wars. But like, you know, I love that. I thought that was beautiful. But the reality is like, it's just three nice movies and that's all Star Wars is. Star Trek is a whole, you know, movies, TV shows, series, you know, a whole world, a whole universe that has been created.
Yeah. I did actually like the Star Wars prequel movies because they got deeper into the different political machinations and all these different plot lines that were necessary to create this situation. But that's what I like about Star Trek is that it's so much about cultural conflict and ethics and political ethics and morality. In particular, I remember when you said DS9, I thought of one of my favorite episodes is when Captain Sisko does this like false flag to get the Romulans into the war.
It's like, I literally just watched that this week.
Did you?
So in the pale moonlight, I think it's called, just, or something like that.
Yeah, it's just so powerful because it's like they're in this war situation and the main character does something that's totally morally evil.
Yeah.
The greater good, but then he's struggling with his conscience.
One of it's the like best is, episodes. Yeah. And how he ends it with saying,
"Oh yeah,
I would do it again."
Yeah.
And I think that was real. That was real. Yes. Is it immoral what he did? Yes, absolutely. You can't do evil that good may come about it. But that's the whole point is like war corrupts even the most noble, because Sisko is presented as one of the most noble of all men. He is the best of us. But war, what does it do to us? It really was a beautiful, I think it was one of the best, like, you know, in science fiction world, like, you know, being an anti-war person, it was so powerful because it really made it clear what war does to us. Even there is no such thing as a good war. Yes, there can be a just war. Don't get me wrong. And as they present it in Star Trek Next Generation, this is a just war that the Federation is fighting. But that doesn't mean every action in that just war is good. And I love that because it was like, and I love the fact they didn't try to kind of do, which they did sometimes in earlier seasons, earlier Star Trek was just wave away and make it like Sisko didn't, you know, like, no, Sisko was like, I did this. I feel super guilty. It's awful. And I do it again because we got to win the war. That's what people do in war. And that's why war is awful. Why war is hell, because good people do bad things in it.
Final comment. All right. Do you any other sci-fi universes that you particularly enjoy?
I have really gotten into, again, the Isaac Asimov robot series. These are unbelievably prescient, because Asimov wrote them originally, started in the 40s and the 50s. He wrote some later ones in the 80s, which aren't as good, but you know, but he's writing about, like, it's basically if you're interested in AI and the potential problems with AI and things like that, he's talking about this in the 50s. He's literally writing this before the term artificial intelligence had even been invented. And he's doing such a good job of kind of talking about the challenges of machines that can think, and what does that mean for us? And I picked them back up. I think I read not all of them. I read a few of them years and years and years ago. And when I decided to write this book on artificial intelligence, my nonfiction book, I was like, I picked them back up and I was like, wow, this guy is nailing it as far as understanding. Asimov himself, you know, does not have a good worldview in a lot of ways, but it doesn't really come in on this one. And so that's one that I've been geeked up about. But the other one is, this is one. Okay. Have you heard of the Sun Eater series? Okay.
I think I have, but no, I don't really know.
It's recent. And okay. So I put out there on X at one point, like, what are some good science fiction, Catholic science fiction? And by Catholic science fiction, I don't mean SB, like in my science fiction book, it's people are Catholic. It doesn't have to be like that. I'm not saying that, but like, you know, written by Catholics that have a Catholic worldview, you know, you could say Lord of the Rings is Catholic fantasy, even though there's no explicitly Catholic. And a number of people brought up the Sun Eater series, which is a 7-volume series. The 7th volume literally is coming out this month. And it's Dune-like. If you know Dune, it's very much an epic. And it's interesting that the author, I can't remember how to pronounce his last name, like Chris Rocchio or Rocio or something like that. I'm about to finish the first book in the series. And it's interesting because I was asking Michael M.R. Leonard in my podcast the other day, who got endorsed by the guy who wrote this book, this series of books. Like, there's some, in this future, it's set thousands and thousands of years in the future, but it's still humans and things like that. And like, there's like a couple gay marriages in it, like where they mention to people who are, you know, his husband and her wife, stuff like that. And they show, it doesn't go into it and like endorse it, but it just kind of has this reality. And it kind of set off my alarms. Like, oh, I don't really want to deal with this type of stuff. But he said, Michael Leonard, who I was talking to yesterday, he said, read the whole series. Basically he's a Catholic, a revert. The author is Chris, and you could look up like Sun Eater
series. Yeah, I'll look it up.
I feel bad that I don't remember the author. I don't have it in front of me here. But basically, he's being published by traditional science, you know, traditional publisher. Yeah, Christopher Rocchio, I think it is how you pronounce his last name. And I've been told that read the whole thing and it gets really explicitly like Catholic ethos, not Catholic specifically, but like, I'm the first book is just phenomenal. And everybody tells me the first book is the worst of them. So anyway, that's another one I'm into right now. Like I said, I'm only finishing the first book. I have not read the whole, I can't endorse the whole thing, but all so far it's incredibly impressive. He is such a talented writer. I mean, like, I hope I am 1% as good a writer as he is. I mean, that's how good I think this is.
So, fantastic. Cool. All right. Well, everybody check out Shard of Eden. Buy your signed copy while supplies last. They are going, are standing by.
It is wild. I mean, I was literally apologizing to people, like, and I just got my second shipment in yesterday, and so I do have copies now. But like, I'd sold out of my first batch I bought, and I was like, oh shoot. And I'm telling people, oh, I'll get to you as soon as I can. And fortunately it did come. So, and by the way, I'm sending you a copy. I'll tell
cool.
you. Know,
cool. Excellent. Copy.
But I had to wait. That's the thing. I couldn't send out my beta readers. They had to wait because people had bought them. I'm like, I got to send those out first, people who paid. And so I was like, sent those out. But yeah. So yeah, Shard of Eden, I think people enjoy it. I think if you like science fiction, you're Catholic, you'll really enjoy it. And I think even if you don't like science fiction, but you like speculative fiction, things like that. And my wife really likes Hunger Games. And she was like, you know, I'm not a science fiction, but I like Hunger Games, which is kind of like speculative fiction. I think you'll enjoy it. So shardofeden.com though.
Excellent. All right. Well, thanks a lot, Eric. God bless everybody. And we'll see you next time on the Lay Apostolate. Adios.